Tommy McNeil. Venezuela's president indicates that he's open to talks with the opposition. AP correspondent Mike Rossier reports.
A week into street demonstrations in Venezuela, President Nicolas Maduro has told a state-owned Russian news agency he's open to talks with the opposition. Maduro said other countries could mediate, mentioning Mexico, Uruguay, Bolivia, the Vatican, and Russia as possible candidates. But after meeting with U.S. lawmakers on Capitol Hill, Venezuelan opposition envoy Carlos Vecchio said,
"We want to end the usurpation of power of Nicolas Maduro, setting a transitional government and calling for a new election."
And Senator Marco Rubio minced no words.
Maduro's criminal organization, because it is akin to a mafia family, they are terrorists.
Mike Gracia, Washington.
The United States and the Taliban have agreed to establish two technical teams to determine details for the eventual withdrawal of all American and NATO troops from Afghanistan and for preventing terrorists from using Afghan soil against America and its allies. That's according to the insurgent group on Wednesday. The chief Taliban negotiator revealed the details after nearly a week of marathon discussions, which concluded on Saturday in Qatar with the U.S. Special Representative for Afghanistan Reconciliation, Zalmay Khalilzad. Coast Guard officials in Djibouti say that they have recovered the bodies of at least 48 people who died when two migrant boats capsized in the Red Sea on Tuesday. An officer speaking on condition of anonymity told VOA Somali that 16 people aboard the boats survived. In a statement, the International Organization of Migration, IOM, confirmed the number of actual survivors. Again, Coast Guard officials there saying that they've recovered the bodies of at least 48 people. More at voanews.com. This is VOA News. U.S. President Trump is blasting America's intelligence community after top officials contradicted him on several topics during a Senate hearing yesterday. AP Washington correspondent Sagar Magani.
The nation's intelligence chief said the Iran nuclear deal is working and that the nuclear threat from Tehran has at least temporarily dropped. The president tweets, "Perhaps intelligence should go back to school," flatly saying the officials are wrong. The president writes the intelligence people seem to be extremely passive and naive about the dangers from Iran, which he says is coming very close to the edge. At a hearing on threats to the U.S., the officials directly contradicted the president on topics from North Korea to ISIS, while making no mention of what he calls a crisis at the southern border. Sagar Magani at the White House.
Negotiators from China and the United States are meeting in Washington in a second round of talks on the ongoing trade dispute between the economic superpowers. Chinese Vice Premier Liu He and U.S. Trade Representative Robert Lighthizer led their respective delegations Wednesday in 2 days of discussions over Washington's longstanding complaints that Beijing forces U.S. companies to transfer their technology advances to Chinese firms and that it limits access to China's vast market. The trade talks are the result of an agreement last month between U.S. President Trump and Chinese President Xi Jinping to stop the tariff conflict between the two countries for 90 days starting on New Year's Day. The European Union on Wednesday rebuffed Britain's efforts to renegotiate the terms of its exit from the EU. British lawmakers voted Tuesday night to send Prime Minister Theresa May back to Brussels to try to get better terms for its planned March 29th divorce from the continent's 28-nation EU. But European Commission President Jean-Claude Juncker told EU lawmakers that while he will listen to May's ideas about changing the pact that was agreed to late last year, it remains the best and only deal possible. He said officials will do their utmost to help Britain sign on the current text.
There can and will be agreement with the United Kingdom so that we can move on and move forward together with our new partnership. We will work day and night to make it happen and to ensure that we are ready in case it does not.
And May said her government has not decided exactly how it will try to change the European Union divorce deal to address concerns about the passage of people and trade at the border between EU member Ireland and Northern Ireland, which is part of Britain. I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Botte in Washington. Today is Thursday, the 31st day of January, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Nigeria's appeals court says the trial of the country's chief justice must go ahead.
The issue has and remains that Nigeria is a democratic constitutional democracy, and therefore the spirit and the letter of the constitution must be respected, especially by the highest office in the land of the president.
Segun Sowumi is the spokesman for former Nigerian Vice President Atiku Abubakar. A number of East African countries have dropped in the 2018 Corruption Perception Index. Sierra Leone frees a woman who kills her abusive boyfriend. Seven European nations end their latest standoff over migrants. And Zimbabwe pastor and activist Evan Mawerere remains defiant after being released from jail late Wednesday.
I was locked up with men who were taken from their homes and accused of crimes that they did not commit. It is a tragedy and a shame that this is where we are as a nation.
South Sudan destroys some unexploded landmines, and Uganda says it has lost over 32% of its wetland in the last 20 years. Those stories, plus our listener of the day, are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Nigeria's appeals court says the trial of the country's chief justice for false declaration of assets must go ahead. The ruling late Wednesday removes a temporary stay on the trial. President Muhammadu Buhari said the suspended Chief Justice Walter Onegin on the orders of the Code of Conduct Tribunal. The United States and European Union have expressed concerns that the removal of the Chief Justice could undermine the credibility of Nigeria's February 16 presidential election. Segun Sowumi is the spokesman for former Nigerian Vice President Atiku Abubakar, who is also the presidential candidate of the main opposition People's Democratic Party.
The position of His Excellency Atiku Abubakar, indeed the position of the PDP and the position of all right-thinking Democrats in Nigeria, has never been that the Chief Justice of Nigeria should avoid trial or not be tried. The issue has and remains that Nigeria is a democratic constitutional democracy, and therefore the spirit and the letter of the constitution must be respected, especially by the highest office in the land of the president. Once the court process are allowed to go their course, we expect proper, free, fair adjudication of the case. I do not want the members of the international community to mistake our action on the issue of the CJA to mean we condone or accept corruption. No. What we were crying about and what we still remain crying about is that we do not want a tendency where institutions of state will begin to abuse the law.
But President Muhammadu Buhari has said repeatedly that he acted on the order or the directive of the Code of Conduct Tribunal.
I am sure you have now found out that the same President Muhammadu Buhari has now gone on to do what he ought to have done in the first instance, which is now refer the case to the NJC. A bit like an afterthought, putting the cart before the horse, and then because of the outcry of the international community, the outcry of Nigerians, the outcry of civil society, he's now trying to backtrack. If he backtracks and obeys the law, we don't have a problem with him.
This decision to put the Chief Justice on trial is coming just almost 2 weeks before Nigeria's presidential election. I wonder if the former Vice President Abubakar, does he share the view of, say, the United States, the European Union, that this decision to put the Chief Justice on trial could undermine the credibility of the February election?
The fact remains that we are merely quarreling with the procedure, and we are raising alarm on the breach of the Constitution. We have no interest, and we seek no gain or no profit from saying that someone who has committed a crime should be made to face the law according to the rules of our country. Therefore, we will be as suspicious as everybody has been relative to the hamstringing and the overusage of executive power by the presidency, who is also an interested party in an election. And the only way to get Nigerian leader or indeed any African leader to reduce the need to interfere with the democratic process is for the consequences to be clearly spelled out before they infringe on those rights.
Segun Sowumi is the spokesman for former Nigerian Vice President and PDP presidential candidate Atiku Abubakar. You're speaking with me from Abuja. a Sierra Leonean woman who was serving a life sentence for killing her abusive boyfriend, was released this week after years of legal battles. The mandatory sentence for murder in Sierra Leone is the death penalty, but this mandatory sentence prohibits courts from taking into account mitigating circumstances, such as women who are victims of domestic abuse and kill their abusive partners. Aminata had her sentence commuted to life imprisonment before being granted her appeal. Rebecca Wood is executive director of Advocate, which helped Aminata with her legal proceedings.
We hope with Aminata's case that Advocate can bring to the attention of the government of Sierra Leone, and particularly those within the criminal justice system, about the limitations of the mandatory death sentence for murder. With the requirement of a mandatory death penalty where an individual is found guilty of murder, it doesn't allow the court to take into account mitigating circumstances such as periods of prolonged abuse. So we hope that this at least draws attention to the limitation of the mandatory death sentence, but also encourages those involved with arresting and prosecuting and trying women accused of murder to take a more considered approach. And
what other activism is being done to counter gender-based violence as well? Because obviously this is great news about Aminata's case, but one of the roots of the problem is also gender-based violence.
I think one important part is ensuring that women are aware of their rights. We really often see that our clients don't know the services that are available to protect them if they're experiencing abuse within their home or within their community.
And how many women are there like Aminata in the Sierra Leone prison system right now?
So presently, Advocate has over 15 clients of women on trial for murder. And in many of those cases, the clients have acted violently in response to abuse that they've received, experienced from an abusive partner. We've also seen girls attempt murder or are accused of committing murder towards a violent parent or grandparent. So I think it's common knowledge in Sierra Leone that abuse within the home and gender-based violence particularly is prevalent. I think the limitation is that this is not yet being considered as a mitigating factor within their case. And often these women and girls are perceived to be criminals rather than people who've experienced violence and need support and protection.
Is there a movement in the Sierra Leonean government, in parliament, et cetera, to change the law so that it would consider this a mitigating circumstance?
Over the last 10 years, there have been numerous calls to abolish the mandatory death sentence for murder. So by abolishing the death penalty and abolishing the mandatory sentence, that does give the court the power to consider these mitigating circumstances. But this is yet to be accepted by the government or taken to parliament for a vote. A new government came to power in Sierra Leone in April 2018, so we're hopeful that the constitutional review process would be resumed and that would give an opportunity to take further action for the abolishment of the death penalty.
That was Rebecca Wood, Executive Director of Advocate. She was speaking to Ricky Stryak from Sierra Leone's capital, Freetown. Zimbabwe pastor and activist Evan Mawarere was released from prison Wednesday night on bail after spending 2 weeks in jail for leading protests against high fuel prices. Columbus Mavunga has more from Harare.
After his release Wednesday night, activist Pastor Evan Mawarere told waiting reporters that he wanted to see a doctor immediately as conditions at Kurubi, Zimbabwe's maximum prison, were not conducive for human habitation. He says he should not have been arrested as he did not commit a crime. Mawarere says he only exercised his right to ask the government to address Zimbabwe's ailing economy.
I must let you know that I was locked up with well over 300 young men and some old men, 65-year-old and 70-year-old, after being beaten by soldiers and police. I was locked up with men who were taken from their homes with their families and accused of crimes that they did not commit. It is a tragedy and a shame that this is where we are as a nation.
Mawarere is among more than 1,000 people Zimbabwe security officials arrested after the three-day protest against a more than 150% fuel increase. They are now facing firing charges. He says he's not afraid of the subversion charge, which carries a 20-year sentence if convicted.
The reason I spoke up is because of my belief in true freedom for people. Our intention has never been to overthrow a government, has never been to topple a government. All I've asked for is that our country be fixed. happen. So if you ask me, is my intention to continue my struggle, I have no choice. Zimbabwe is the only country I have. It's the only home I have. It's the only place my children can call their own. And so every Zimbabwean has no choice but to continue the struggle. The struggle cannot be subcontracted. It is us who will fight for our nation, and it is us that must be present for that fight.
The arrest of Mawarire and other protesters during the hashtag Shutdown Zim campaign have attracted condemnation of rights groups, citing the brutality of security forces. But George Charamba, the spokesman of President Emmerson Mnangagwa, has come to the defense of Zimbabwe's security forces for their actions during the protests.
There's a fundamental question to ask here. Why so indulgently condone violence that we so gratuitously visited on this society? Why do that? When that happens, necessarily, the authority of the state is in question. And I can assure you, if the authority of the state is in question, the state has an obligation to demonstrate that it exists to ensure law and order. And that's exactly what happened.
Last week, a group of NGOs called the Crisis in Zimbabwe Coalition wrote to Namibian President Hage Geingob, the current chairman of the Southern African Development Community, to intervene now before what it called Zimbabwe's deteriorating human rights situation reaches alarming levels. Columbus Mavunga for VOA's Daybreak Africa, Harare.
You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Botti in Washington. Today is Thursday, January 31st. Daybreak Africa time is coming up at 17 minutes past the hour. A number of East African countries, including Kenya, Uganda, and Burundi, dropped points in the 2018 Transparency International Corruption Perception Index. Maureen Ojiambo reports from Nairobi.
Kenya has dropped 1 point in the Global Corruption Perception Index, CPI, released yesterday Wednesday by Transparency International. The report says Kenya obtained a score of 27 points out of 100, a decline from 28 points in 2017. Transparency International Programs Manager in Kenya, Sheila Masinde, says until the corruption offenders are convicted, there is a lot left to be done in the country's fight against corruption. Masinde said that there has not been much efforts to fight corruption in the country, as she faults investigators who undertake corruption cases.
When you look at Kenya's performance in the last 5 years, you can tell that there's really hasn't been much progress in the fight against corruption. At least that's what the results are telling us. And we need to move beyond the prosecutions. And the next course is to ensure that these prosecutions are successful, that there's very tight evidence presented to guarantee convictions for people who are found culpable of corruption. So, because until we see these people convicted and until we see them going to jail and being given very stringent jail terms, and Kenya also recovering the assets that have been lost to corruption, then we can't really say that we are winning the war against corruption.
On the regional level, Rwanda is ranked highest in East Africa region, reaping 56 points, followed by Tanzania with 36 points, Kenya and Uganda scoring 27, and Burundi with 17 points. Masinde says other regional countries are doing better because of the political goodwill.
It's more or less about the political will to fight corruption. And you'll see that in some of these countries, it has been taken up at the highest levels.
President Uhuru Kenyatta in the most recent past has emphasized fighting corruption, even though Kenyans think otherwise. Phyllis Kamau, a Kenyan, says the government has failed its citizens since there has been no action taken against corrupt individuals.
I think the government is doing nothing, and the government has all the resources that they have. They have the judiciary, there is the courts, there is everything.
The Transparency International Corruption Perception Index highlights Denmark and New Zealand as the top countries with scores of 88 and 87 respectively. The bottom countries are Somalia, Syria, and South Sudan, with scores of 10, 13, and 13 respectively. Transparency International says an effective anti-corruption efforts are premised on three pillars: political will, effective institutions, and engaged citizenry. Reporting for VOA's Daybreak Africa, I am Moreno Jembo in Nairobi, Kenya.
The United Nations Mine Action Service, or UNMAS, in South Sudan says there are still many undetected landmines across South Sudan. A program manager at UNMAS says up to 39 square kilometers of land in South Sudan still needs to be clear of landmines and unexploded ordnances. On Wednesday, UNMAS destroyed two large bombs about 15 kilometers outside the capital. Winnie Rono was there and has this report from Juba.
Quiet! Firing!
That's the sound of a 50-kilogram bomb being demolished by UNMAS while buried inside a 1.5-meter hole in Jebel Blinyang Bare village outside Juba today. It was the demolition of the 1-millionth explosive item in South Sudan. Dirkoch Baraj, head of the National Mine Action Authority in South Sudan, says many unexploded ordnances remain across the country. He says the worst area is the southern part of the country. Baraj says he hopes the remaining contaminated areas will be demined so that the land is safe for farming and development.
The most contaminated areas of the South Sudan are in Equatoria generally, because the theater of the war was in Equatoria.
Richard Balter, program manager of the United Nations Mine Action Service in South Sudan, says the unexploded ordnances and landmines originated from Sudan and were planted in South Sudan during the war for independence. He says the two unexploded ordnances demolished today were found by the South Sudan People's Defense Forces and the National Police Service 2 weeks ago next to Juba International Airport.
Over the course of the last 14 years, together, we have assessed and cleared 1.25 billion square meters, which is 1,250 square kilometers. The number that matters right now is that which remains. And our estimate at the moment is approximately 39 square kilometers, comprised of 210 minefields, 124 cluster strikes, and 35 battle areas.
Balter says he hopes the unexploded ordnances will be cleared over the next 5 years. He says UNMAS has documented the number of the victims of explosions, but more people could have been killed who didn't make it to the hospital.
Nine people have been hurt this month alone. One person killed and eight injured. Overall, 1,383 people killed and 3,652 people injured. But the number will grow.
Balter says many unsuspecting children have died from landmines and exploded devices. He says they often play with the objects or take them home, which puts more lives at a risk. He wants the public to be extremely cautious.
If anything looks like a bomb, if they suspect it, unless they absolutely know something is safe, don't touch it.
UNMAS says it is working to create a safe and secure environment for the people of South Sudan. For VOA News, I am Winnie Serino in Juba.
After spending close to 2 weeks at sea because no country would allow them to disembark, Italian Prime Minister Giuseppe Conte said 47 migrants on the Dutch-flagged Sea Watch 3 finally would come off that vessel. Europe had been arguing over the fate of the migrants, and Italy agreed to let them disembark only after a half dozen countries came forward to take them in. Sabina Castelfranco reports from Rome.
Prime Minister Giuseppe Conte ended the latest migrant standoff on Wednesday, announcing the 47 migrants would soon disembark. The migrants had been stuck on the vessel since their rescue off the coast of Libya, January 19th. The Sea-Watch 3 rescue vessel has been moored off southern Sicily since Friday. Europe has been struggling with how to deal with the migrants' respective arrivals since Italy's populist government, which came to power last March, announced it would close its ports to humanitarian vessels. It was the second time in a month the Sea-Watch 3 had been stranded at sea with rescued migrants and no safe port that would allow it to dock. Speaking in Milan on Wednesday, Prime Minister Conte said Luxembourg came forward as the latest country to answer Italy's request for assistance. The Prime Minister added that Luxembourg joined Germany, France, Portugal, Romania and Malta in agreeing to take some of the migrants from the Sea-Watch 3 ship operated by a German aid group. The migrants are expected to disembark in the coming hours. Deputy Prime Minister and Interior Minister Matteo Salvini said, "Mission accomplished. Once again, thanks to the commitment of the Italian government and the determination of our Interior Ministry, Europe has been forced to intervene and take on its responsibilities. Salvini added, on the basis of the documentation gathered, an investigation should be opened to shed light on the conduct of the NGO. Stefan Seibert, spokesman for German Chancellor Angela Merkel, said Germany has agreed to accept some of the migrants, declaring it is clear a common and lasting solution is needed in Europe to the issue. The UN Refugee Agency says on average 6 people a day lost their lives attempting to reach Europe by way of the Mediterranean last year. Sabina Castelfranco for VOA News, Rome.
Uganda says it has lost over 32% of its wetland in the last 20 years to farming and infrastructure development. One environmental expert warns that this could have many effects on the country's ecosystem and the economy. Mugumi Davis Rakamish reports from Kampala.
While addressing journalists about World Wetland Day in Kampala Wednesday, Environmental Minister Maria Goretti Chitutu Chimono said both the government and people are to blame for depleting wetlands.
The high levels of destruction, these were experienced in the 1990s. And most of the activities which destroyed wetlands were industries, and you'll find that most of those areas were gazetted as industries as early as 1960. So that was a mistake at that time, and these are things which we are now trying to correct by putting their industrial parks.
Globally, it is estimated that the world lost at least 60% of its wetlands in the last 10 years alone. World Wetlands Day is celebrated every year on February 2nd. The day marks the date of the adoption of the Convention on Wetlands on February 2nd in 1971, which was adopted in the Iranian city of Ramsar. This year's theme is wetlands and climate change, a recognition of the effect of wetlands on climate. At least 40% of Uganda rains result from wetlands, according to the Ministry of Environment. Chitutu Chimono says destruction of wetlands can result into loss of lives and property.
And people are experiencing blowing off their roofs, roofs of schools, roofs of buildings. That goes back to the disaster. And we now have to go back and readjust our budgets and fund the disaster. We could be cutting off a road and then funding the disaster. So this disrupts development.
Collins Oloya works as an environmental expert in the Ministry of Environment, agrees.
We will have widespread flooding in Uganda, disrupting many built infrastructures, including road, electricity, buildings, which will require a lot of money to restore the wetlands first and also to relocate the projects which has already been established.
Oloya says wetlands work as natural sponge to control and purify water. Trees, root mats and other wetland vegetation also slow the speed of flood waters and distribute them more slowly. Wetlands also act as water storage and reduce soil erosion. Oloya says people should simply avoid destroying wetlands because it directly impacts on their lives.
Wetlands absorbs and sinks extraordinary carbon dioxide in our atmosphere. It is estimated that 1 hectare of wetlands stores 64 tons of carbon dioxide equivalent per year. So if you destroy the wetlands, you will be releasing immense amount of greenhouse gases in terms of carbon dioxide and therefore escalating the global warming.
Oloya says the government is providing alternative means of livelihood so people can stop destroying the wetlands. The government is also cancelling permits and titles for people operating on wetlands. For VOA News, I am Mugume Davis Rwakarinji in Kampala, Uganda.
And that's it for this Thursday, January 31st edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer David Vandy, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as sports editor Samson O'Malley, along with our engineer John Ellison, I'm James Barton, Washington, wishing everyone in Africa a very good day.
Take your pick, watch on television, log on to the internet, or listen right here on the radio. Hello, I am Shaka Sali, the host of Straight Talk Africa from the Voice of America. Each Wednesday night, I'll put you in touch with newsmakers and experts as they, you and I, talk about the most important social and political issues in Africa. Shaka Sali saying, I'll be waiting for your call Wednesday night on Straight Talk Africa from the Voice of America.
Hello, sports fans. This is the voice of America's Sonny Young.
Please join me Monday through Friday at 16:30 and 18:30 UTC for the sunny side of sports. On Fridays, you can also hear my expanded 30-minute edition of the show at 17:30 UTC. Right here on the English to Africa service of the Voice of America.